This week on The Stack, we find out the secrets on how to be a good columnist with Karen Krizanovic, and we also speak to the editor and founder of The Maritime Edit, a magazine about all things Atlantic Canada. Plus, I check in with Monocle's editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, straight from Zurich. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis, and I am Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Coming up here on The Stack, we speak to columnist and Monocle friend Karen Krizanovic on the secrets on how to be a good columnist, and we catch up with James Mullinger from The Maritime Edit. But first, I caught up with Monocle's editor-in-chief Tyler Brulé, currently in Zurich, where the 4th Monocle Quality of Life Conference is currently taking place. I started asking Tyler, how's the weather in Zurich?
Well, weather's amazing, which is good, which is hopefully good for magazine sales as well, because Fernando, as you will recall from one of your visits many summers ago, there's this incredible bathing culture around the lake. And what's always wonderful when you go out on a Saturday morning or really any day during the week is everyone is there first thing in the morning with their copies of the NZZ or the Tagesanzeig or whatever magazine they might like, or you've got the New York Times and people reading the FT, etc., part of the expat community. And that's one of the great things, because it doesn't really make so much sense to be taking your mobile too close to the water, also because it's all wood decking. I'm sure they probably lose quite a few mobile phones over the course of the summer. So this is obviously an environment where having a bit of paper makes a lot of sense.
Absolutely. And I would love to take my copy of the NZZ and Sonntag. And Tyler, you know, Lucy Burnett, he's one of the guests at the conference as well. So tell us a bit more about the paper and how, you know, important it is for Switzerland.
Well, one of the things that we're comparing and contrasting, and I think it's been a bit of a theme, Fernando, over the last few years with our conferences, is looking at the role that media, being it global or local media, plays within the role of the urban environment. Of course, if you're going to challenge government, of course, if you want to have both responsible citizens, but also responsible government and corporate players, you need great, honest media. And so we're in a really unique place, actually, sitting in Zurich, because the NZZ is one of the, well, actually, we've sort of decided it is the oldest newspaper of scale in the world right now. I mean, this is a paper which goes back centuries, given the scale of the paper, also not just within Switzerland, but you have to remember as well, this is really also seen as something of a newspaper of record also in the German-speaking world. So we have the editor-in-chief of the NZZ am Sonntag, which is, you know, when you talk about a paper, you know, when we're measuring this in centuries, the NZZ am Sonntag has only been around for about 2 decades that they decided to launch a Sunday edition. But Lucy's been with the paper for a very, very long time. So we'll be talking about the importance of this brand in really sort of the Swiss consciousness and the German consciousness. But what we're also doing is we're comparing another really interesting startup out of this market, Fernando, which is Republic. And Republic has been really a wonder to watch as a new digital brand, a digital title which only exists really on your screen at the moment. I do believe they do have some print ambitions, though. But what's great about that story, and we saw recently Switzerland, well, particularly Zurich, was named as the city with the highest purchasing power in the world. And so when these guys from Republic went out to raise funds to do long-form journalism, to go and really sort of venture forth and do great reporting, they were able to raise millions and millions of Swiss francs, you know, virtually overnight by selling patronages to their title. So a slightly sort of different subscription model, and one which has been fascinating to watch.
And Tyler, I'm curious to know more about the kiosks there in Zurich. How's the print media in Switzerland doing these days?
Well, the print media is strong in Switzerland because of just you mentioned the kiosk. And kiosk is, in fact, a national brand. It is owned by Valora. So you'll go into any train station and you will see a kiosk with its white and sky blue branding, or you'll see something else called Press and Books. And Press and Books is also owned by the Valora Group, slightly more upscale. They tend to stock more international titles. And this is, you know, you can go into like the most remote ski valley. You can go into pretty much any village. And because of this, you have to really measure this with the power of logistics in this country as well. Because Swiss Post is so strong, it's a very small country. You've also got a very sophisticated rail network. It means it's very easy to get newspapers, magazines to, you know, rather remote valleys overnight without much problem.
Tyler, before I let you go to the lake now, I just want to know what's on your reading list there when you're sunbathing.
Well, probably if I have to steal a couple of titles off of our own shelves, and I should sort of give a shameless plug, you know, anyone who comes by Zurich, one thing we've done is, you know, we have to start doing many more editions of The Stack out of this studio, Fernando, because here in Zurich, literally, I don't know, maybe 10 long steps from where I'm sitting in our radio setup here, we have our own kiosk, a little bit like Kiosk Cafe in London, maybe a bit smaller, but it is a great space where, yeah, you can find the best of the Italian, the German, Japanese, English language, French press, etc. So I would be taking, I love looking at Côte Sud at this time of year. It's a sort of fantasy of the French Riviera. At the same time, I'll probably take the new issue of German Architectural Digest just for, yeah, a bit of sort of decorating porn to look at. Hochparterre, a fantastic Swiss design magazine. Of course, we reference it many times on The Stack. And I always like having the New York Times, and probably New York Times and the New Yorker. That's if you just want to really soak up the sun and have a good deep read.
Thanks, Tyler. We'll be right back with The Stack. Let's talk now about how to be a good columnist. A magazine or a broadsheet would be nothing without a good mix of opinion writers and columnists, of course. To tell us more about the importance of a great column, I've invited a Monaco friend and, of course, a columnist for several media, ranging from The Times to The Telegraph. And, of course, she was a former agony aunt on 90s title Sky Magazine. I've started asking Karen Krizanovich, what's so appealing about becoming a columnist?
Everybody thinks they can be a columnist, I think, oh, what a wheeze. It's actually harder than you might think. But the passion for magazines and printed matter has always been with me. And when I was growing up, I used to just read everything and just love magazines. They're like jewels. And I never thought I'd write, because I thought they just happened, you know, because I lived in a rural Illinois and nobody, you know, we were lucky to learn how to read, really. But they seem like magical things. I think printed matter, books and magazines and newspapers and journals are just magical things.
What are the challenges? Because you're very right, it's not everyone that can write a column. I know some people say, oh, I can write this thing online. But, you know, columnists are still paid. People still want them to be in their publication. But there must be quite a lot of challenges. For example, I think you have to focus perhaps on a few topics. You can't be too general as well.
Well, I've written columns for national newspapers. In fact, I've had several. I've written them for international magazines. I've written them online. I've written them for monthlies, for weeklies, and for dailies. There's a big, big difference between print for all of those time periods and also online. And I can say that even those people like India Knight, who's, you know, obviously very well respected, I think she cheats because she chops her columns up into smaller topics. I think if you're going to pick a topic, and this is a challenge, make it succinct and efficient so it works for the entire column, not chop it up. It's very easy to sort of have a little sushi medley of great juicy topics, but I think it's a lot more challenging to stick to one topic. For example, some of the best work I ever did was in the 90s for a little freebie magazine that was called, there were three of them, Girl About Town. And there was another one as well. I can't remember exactly what it was, but because I used to write them so much that I lost track. And I would do columns like Carrot Killer, which would be about vegans and do they ever worry about the fact that Billy Carrot doesn't come home to his family that night because you're killing something that's alive. You know, I mean, that sort of thing. But it was fun, or getting married or getting divorced or going on a date or thinking somebody's crazy and they're not. Of course, you can't say crazy now. But so I think what you have to do is really pick out a topic that you can sustain and that you can sustain better than the person sitting in the tube seat next to the person who's reading you. And I would always stay away from politics or religion or sports.
I was going to ask you that because, of course, sometimes your columns can be quite personal. You know, you do talk about sex, for example. Does it affect sometimes your real life, you know, especially these days? Because I think when you started, you know, perhaps, you know, you couldn't read all the articles online and everything. And now it's so widespread. Of course, you see it in the print, but perhaps you see it online as well. Mm. Do you worry about those things as well?
Well, I guess I'm most famous for the Dear Karen column, which basically ran for a decade and was Sky Magazine, which is now defunct, was their number one advertising page. I wish I'd known. I would have asked for more money. And I still get recognized for that to this very day. I actually was writing to someone in the film industry, and they said, oh, I really love your column. I'm like, oh. because I wrote about sex and because I wrote about it from a comedy angle, because I think it's hilarious, and because everybody is interested in sex. And the way I was raised is that we talked about sex all the time, and I thought everybody's parents were like that. No. I'm amazed how people remember it, but also how it hasn't been online because the magazine has gone under. It was sold and then the archives are gone. So I'm the one that's put the columns back online. And they really haven't aged well, I have to say. I was sexist and racist and I was just against everybody equally. So I think I was really as un-PC as you possibly could be while not sounding too stupid.
But you've changed. I mean, you wrote about relationships and sex quite recently. An article in the Times as well, right?
Yeah, article in the Times, which was sold on to several other newspapers and magazines, to my surprise. But I would go to parties back in the day and they'd go, oh, hi, who are you? Wait a minute, you look familiar. Because I did a lot of television as well. And then they'd find out who I was. And the men's body language would change. They'd be, oh, you write about sex. And their legs would spread. And they'd kind of like, hey, you know, I got a shot. It's like, no, you don't. Wow. Sorry. But it was interesting because it was interesting how people think that if you talk about sex or write about sex, you're going to be laying naked in the street.
As an American here, you know, living here in the UK, do you see any difference between American and British columnists? And if so, what are they?
Oh, huge. Massive. I find the Americans have a very different sense of humor. The British know how to make a joke. I mean, I have been living here a long time. So despite the just-got-off-the-boat accent, I have been here a long time. So culturally, I'm English, and I sound American. Americans don't really have irony. They have to be very careful because people take things literally. They don't understand a joke most of the time. Somebody's always going to take it seriously, and me here too. But also, there's a cultural difference here as far as education goes. Obviously, Britain is closer to Europe. It's slightly more globally aware because the media is very different here. And the ordinary citizen, I would say, is more well-informed than the ordinary American. And I'm not talking about New Yorkers or L.A. or anybody in the East Coast particularly. So you can make classical allusions without being pretentious, or you can make a comment about ordinary culture, and it can be picked up on rather than having to explain all the time. So also, I think Americans have a tendency to be slightly more aggressive and slightly more hardline because they need to cut through a stratum of static. Whereas I think in Britain, you don't have to do that. I mean, it's the same with film critics. You pick out your favorite film critics who kind of back up your own taste. And I think it's the same with columnists. But I mean, I used to love Maureen Dowd, and then I just felt she was kind of poking me with a sharp stick too much. I don't want somebody preaching to me. I don't want somebody that's going to wind me up. I want somebody that's going to inform me, make me laugh, make me think. I don't want anybody that's going to infuriate me because I can do that myself.
You're very right. There's a fine balance between being too preachy, even if it's the person's on your side, let's say. It can be a bit, you know, jarring.
Or telling me something I already know. Yeah. You know, some of these columnists, I think they're writing for the lowest common denominator. Bless them.
Do you have any favorites?
Well, Caitlin Moran, I like her writing style an awful lot. I love Anthony Lane, who, of course, is American. I love Ian Parker. Actually, I'm not sure if he writes columns, but I think he used to. Who else? I love Lester Bangs from way back when. I mean, Charles Charmery. Brian Case used to write some wonderful columns. Now, this is going way far back now. I think Melanie Reed in The Times is actually very interesting. She's a tetraplegic who, you know, had a writing accident. And I think it's interesting that they've kept her on. And we get to see what life's like from her side of things. I
mean, she's quite honest, right?
She's very honest. Being a columnist for such a long time in so many different ways. I mean, at one point I was writing 6 national columns. You can tell what a good column is. And, for example, in the Monocle, Spring Weekly has some wonderful commentary in it, which I think could be made into columns. The difference between online and print is that I don't think Dear Karen could really survive with commentary. Because nowadays, a bad column is pretty much a blog. What's the difference between a blog and a column? Columnist has to be really good. You have to want to pay to read this. It's almost like you're doing a stand-up to the world. And if you have comments, a lot of times I'll notice that the comments are funnier than the columnist. But the columnist is merely setting up this conjecture. How about this? I think this. And so it's very easy to react and very hard to be creative.
Is there a difference between writing for a magazine and a newspaper?
Huge. Huge. A magazine hangs around. I mean, even if it's a weekly magazine, it hangs around. People used to tell me they'd pick up things on the tube, you know, late at night and drunk, and they'd be reading my stuff, which is great. And I've had people pull me aside in parties going, yours is the best thing in that magazine. Like, oh, you tell me when you have some coffee. Okay. But it's lovely. It's lovely to hear that and to have people email you when email wasn't prevalent. Gosh, I sound like a dinosaur. But magazines, you have to write something that's slightly more long-lasting. It's more like a book. It needs to be backed up a bit more. With a newspaper, it has to be really cutting edge, very current. And it's best if you can get some kind of research or something backing you up that hasn't been published yet.
And Karen, what do you want to write about now? Because I know, I'm sure you're going to keep, you know, writing about relationships and sex, but perhaps a little bit more something country-like?
Yeah, I would. I've gone back to my roots. I used to ride when I was a teenager. Rode when I first came over. That's horses, I mean. And I stopped, and I've gone back into, and now I'm a fanatic about side saddle, which makes me sound like I've got no teeth. But it's fascinating. It's a lot of fun, and nobody writes about it. And I realize it's very niche. That's like saying I'm going to write about a unicycle or, you know, maybe balancing a ball and my nose is going to be interesting. But, yeah, I'm passionate about that, and I think that the print world, particularly for niche titles, we know is shrinking or has to be very, very carefully targeted. And, for example, I read Horse and Hound, but there's no hound in it. You know, there's nothing about hunting, which, of course, doesn't have anything to do with foxes at all now, I stress. It's all trail chasing. It's not competitive, which is its allure. But there's nothing there for people that are sort of interested in this more aesthetic form of riding as a lot of dressage. So I understand that people have to do what makes money and what people want to buy. But I would love to do a column on side saddle simply because I think I could write about it in a way that even if you didn't like horses or women, you would want to read it. There are men that ride side saddle, of course, because from World War I, men had lost parts of their legs. They weren't unable to ride any other way. So they'd go out aside and stable. Don't get me started on it. I would love to do that. Of course, I think relationships are really interesting, particularly now that I've got a lot of mileage. I wish I could write a little bit more about it and give people the benefit of what I know. And I think that it's a lot more to do with realizing that 50% of the problems are your problems, which I think is really important. But the most important thing is try not to get too serious about things. And also, when you're writing for people, keep it tight, keep it easy, and keep it funny, because everything's funny.
Good way to end. Thank you so much, Karen. It was lovely to have you. And finally, here on The Stack, we head to Canada indeed. Eastern Canada, to be more precise. A year ago, James Mullinger, together with Pamela Mullinger, launched The Maritime Edit, a beautiful publication celebrating Atlantic Canada. James explains how's the tide of faring 1 year on.
Amazing. I mean, it's obviously been a roller coaster year. And, you know, when we spoke a year ago, I was kind of, you know, obviously very excited about the fact that we were the first ever national print publication to be based out of New Brunswick, celebrating Atlantic Canadian heritage and culture and kind of sharing all of the things that we love about living here, working here, and people love visiting here for with the rest of the world. And so for the following year, the best thing I can say is that we've been doing more of the same. And that was ultimately always the plan. But the way in which I think things have grown is that we moved out into doing everything from events and fundraising events and really just trying to kind of grow the business and let more people know what we do. But it's been, you know, a fantastic year, full of surprises. And I think the biggest surprise for us was how quickly people in other parts of the country and other parts of the world tapped into the magazine, you know, so we get so many letters and emails from people, if, for example, people in Vancouver or even in Tokyo saying that they've come across the magazine and they have no connection to the East Coast of Canada at all, but now want to kind of come and visit and now want to do business here. That for us is really the greatest compliment of all, because it's exactly what we set out to do. We set out to tell the rest of the world about all of the wonderful things that are happening here. We also wanted to give the people here a magazine to be proud of, but also possibly most importantly, to unite the Atlantic provinces. You know, for so long, the Atlantic provinces of Canada have kind of been in competition with each other, which is absurd. It's, I like to think of Atlantic Canada as just as one big city, and it really is. If you visit one part of it, you visit all of it. So for me, it's really, really nice to be uniting the Atlantic provinces, because if one province is doing well, then we're all doing well.
And James, in terms of business, how did the magazine grow? Because from what I can see, you can buy the Maritime Edit in the best, you know, stockist there in Canada, from a newsstand to a supermarket as well.
Yeah, and I think one of the big surprises for us, so we were very lucky to get very good distribution from the beginning, which was, you know, Chapters, Indigo stores, airports across Canada, and hundreds of other independent retailers. One of the things we learned very quickly is that lots of people in rural areas were very, very keen to walk into a store and buy the magazine, even as subscriptions were growing nationally and internationally. We had a lot of people saying to us they wanted to walk into their local Sobeys, which is like a Waitrose, or Shoppers Drug Mart, which is kind of like, you know, Boots in England, or, you know, there's obviously numerous equivalents in America as well. And so that was something that we branched out with this new issue, Volume 5. It's now in all the Sobeys and Shoppers stores. I guess one of the kind of business model or one of the business avenues that we hadn't anticipated, which has proven to be one of the many ways that the magazine has exceeded the expectations that we had in terms of business projections, is we've had a lot of people who have very kind of smart people that have a kind of vested interest in the region prospering, realizing that they needed this magazine in their hotel rooms or at their conferences or as gifts to clients or politicians giving to delegates giving to politicians or foreign dignitaries. And this kind of kicked in almost immediately. It was on issue 2. We had some, but issue 3, it really exploded. And then with this new issue, it's been kind of through the roof, where we've actually kind of struggled to keep up with the demand, which is people wanting to do bulk purchases of 500 or 1,000 copies for, so they can put them in every room of a hotel, or they can give them to every, you know, if there's a Canadian National Chamber of Commerce happening in a particular part of Canada, and they want to give, you know, get delegates from across the country or indeed across the world something to cherish Canada by, they're giving them this product. That for us has been a huge revenue stream, one that we'd never anticipated. And of course, also a wonderful compliment to the product, and also a great way for us to get the word out there to the right people.
And I have the latest issue here in front of me, and I have to say, I always liked your covers, but this one is striking. It's all about the city of Halifax, which I have to be honest, I didn't know much, but excellent article in there. Tell us about what you can find in the latest issue, the summer 2018 one.
For us, that's exactly why we do this. You know, I mean, Halifax is, as the article states, you know, very much a world-class city. It's the biggest city in the Atlantic provinces of Canada. And sometimes for people being based here, they kind of think that everybody knows that. And for us, it's like, no, we're reaching an audience of people who don't know that. So we want to tell them. And this was very much the thought process behind this cover story, was, you know, we want to be setting the agenda. We want to be telling people what's happening here. We've been given this kind of great compliment and this, been put in this position where people are listening to what we're saying and they're discovering new things from us. So we thought, well, what can we tell people? And the growth in Halifax right now is just colossal. You know, this amazing waterfront development, the Queen's Mark, is without question going to become one of the most sought after destinations, probably in all of North America when it opens in a couple of years. I mean, it's just mind blowing. And there's so many of these things happening in Halifax right now that actually the cover, and I'm so pleased you like it. It was actually our art director, Lindsay Vauteur, who I talked about last time I was on the show, who, you know, still is designing every single page of the magazine, which is amazing. I mean, she's an incredible talent and someone that very, very much sums up everything this magazine is about, which is a, you know, world-class creative that chooses to live big in a small town in New Brunswick and continue to do world-class work. And this is, again, something that we've always tried to celebrate, is, you know, it's not a compromise living in a smaller place. If you're great at what you do, you can thrive at that thing anywhere. And so she created this cover from scratch using some imagery, that renderings and so forth, and she's redrawn the whole thing, and it's an original piece of art. celebrating what's happening in Halifax right now and also what's kind of coming in Halifax. We also have a feature on a film that's coming out. It's called The Capital Project, which is made by an amazing New Brunswick team of filmmakers called Rainmaker Productions. And it's about the kind of explosion of the New Brunswick music scene that has kind of occurred in the past 5 years. We have a medical genius by the name of Dr. Stephen Bayer from New Brunswick, who has been making, you know, incredible technological advancements, which again, you know, these are these stories that for whatever reason weren't being told before, or certainly weren't being told on a national level. I think I've mentioned before, you know, I kind of felt, you know, we felt frustrated that we were aware of these incredible people doing incredible things here, and no one was either talking about them or didn't know about them, or there was nowhere to read about them. And so that's what we wanted to do. And I mean, another perfect example is there's a beautiful feature in there, which is one of my favorite features we've run, written by the mayor of Miramichi. Miramichi is one of the most beautiful places in New Brunswick. And the mayor, Adam Lawden, he left Toronto 4 years ago. He was one of Toronto's top TV producers, and he went to Miramichi for essentially, in essence, a slower place of life, or indeed, you know, a better quality of life. But of course, has ended up busier than ever with a huge multimedia company there, and also is now the mayor of the city. So it's one of those classic kind of stories that we like to celebrate, which, you know, some people within the Atlantic provinces might know his story, but people in other parts of Canada and other parts of the world probably don't. And we are, you know, have kind of delightfully become the only way that people get to hear about that. And essentially, that's what it boils down to, is we're writing about businesses that are attracting global audiences and people that are the best at what they do. And they're very successful, but they're under the radar. And that's really one of the things, you know, one of the only kind of struggles we've kind of had in our first year is working against this kind of perception that has existed for years, and it's been perpetuated for years, that the East Coast of Canada is just lobsters and lighthouses. We're doing most of our business in Toronto and in other parts of Canada, and it's trying to, you know, explain to people that everything they've been told about the East Coast of Canada before our magazine existed, it isn't true. And, you know, luckily it seems to be working. And, you know, I think some of the greatest comments we've had is, you know, just hearing from some business people that are now doing business here, or indeed people that are kind of moving here, telling us that the magazine was the kind of thing that tipped the scale for us. So to be seeing an actual, you know, and ultimately, I mean, that's, you know, the magazine exists as a lifestyle magazine. It's to be enjoyed. It's to exist to entertain. But to kind of see this kind of social and political benefit to it as well is a joy for us. It really is.
Thanks, James, from the Maritime Edit. Well, that's it for this week's show. My thanks to our editors Cassie Galpin and George McDonough. If you have any comments or queries, feel free to write to me, actually, at fp@monocle.com. And remember, we're back next Saturday at the same time, and you can always listen to us again on monocle.com or on iTunes. For now, you'll be listening to The Stack. I'm Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Until next time, it's goodbye from me.